Let's have questions in this second session of ours.
Yeah, good. Okay. So one of the questions, you know, when you're talking about, you know, we're like driving along and the wheels are falling off and we're going, oh, my God, what do we do? That's often the first time that people come to Buddhism. So, so what do we do when the wheels are actually, how do we help that person? And in particular,
damage control is the best you can do at that point. You know, to the degree that you have any skill at all, this is, I mean, whether you've learned it or not, some people, like this woman, Sunny, she didn't learn any of this. She had it in her mind. Okay, we could argue she had the karma to have this from the past lives. That's another discussion. But she was able, when the wheels did fall off, she had this extraordinary ability to navigate the disaster and even turn it around. So many of us don't know we will literally collapse and go mad. In other words, you'll crash. So we use whatever ability we have got when this wake-up call comes, you know, and then we try and get help wherever we can. So we are the person who's helping, give the person a hug, heal their wounds, love them, take care of them, look after them, tell them, yes, it was a shocking crash. You don't give them lectures about, you know, all the things I've just said now. And then if the person knows this is something they've got to do, you've got to start, go back to basics and learn to know about mechanics and how to maintain your mind and blah, 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 blah. That's the way to say it. Isn't it? And so how fortunate if we do have a drama that we can have someone to turn to who can help us. We need that badly. We do need help.
And then what if it's not a drama, but Samuel has asked, how can he help his son who's severely depressed?
Well, that is the disaster. That is, depression is one of the disasters. I mean, you know, because we're all little children and the Buddhist view is we come with our own tendencies and even if you've got the best parents in the world, we can see that you can still be a crazy dude and shout and yell and throw chairs at your mummy, or you can get profoundly depressed. So we can see that. Well, this is exactly the same. He is in a disaster. He has had a crash. So the best you can do, Samuel, is love, and just all you can do is love him, support him, be there like a rock of Gibraltar. Don't give him too many lectures. That's what our tendency is as a parent, because we want to make it all go away. You just have to be there like a rock of Gibraltar. You can't do more than that. And of course, this is the other crucial point though, Samuel. It's a bit like you're asking me, what'll I do? My son has got terrible nutrition. He's 20 kilos overweight and I don't know how to help him. Listen to this point. No, if you don't know nutrition, if you don't understand nutrition, you can't help your son. You're absolutely right. So the logic here is, if you don't know your mind, and we're using the Buddhist view here, and I'm going to go into it. If you don't have a model of the mind that you're using to help you understand your mind and your depression and your anger, then you can't help your son except be there for him and love him. But the more skill you have at learning nutrition for yourself, the more you are capable of interpreting and diagnosing and helping another person. So it's exactly the same with the mind, Samuel. But meanwhile, because you're the parent, it's much more painful for the parents because you feel so hopeless, you know. But the other thing is, for me too, it's interesting. We notice in our culture, in our psychology, we never factor in ethics, okay? That sounds like religion. We don't like that. So, you know, often what happens, like a person like you, except you're in your case, your child is depressed. Another case, I remember one mother, she's in tears. What will I do with my 15-year-old daughter? She throws chairs at me. Well, the first thing I ask the mother, and I'll do the same for you, for your son, what are her good qualities? Because you remember in the Buddhist psychology, there's this clear distinction between, you know, the neurotic, unhappy parts of us, which includes depression, and I'm going to describe what depression is, and the positive ones. So if the mother says, well, she lies, she's a thief, she jumps on every boy she meets, she's manipulative, she's a psychopath, then you've got a problem. You have got a problem. But most often the mother would say, she's good, she's got a loving heart, she's honest, she doesn't lie, she doesn't steal, she loves animals. And I say to her, she will be okay. Because ethics is a major point. If a person's got real mental suffering, and if they also don't have ethics, if they lie and steal and rape and kill, then they're the ones who've got serious problems. Now, the trouble with depression is you can be the best person in the world and still have depression because you become so inert, you can't even access your good qualities. You can't even see them. This is the tragedy. So, you know, if you know your son's mind well, you know what he's like and you know his good qualities, part of your job to be his father, and it all totally depends on how receptive he is. Maybe he hates you. I don't know. You haven't said that part, which means you can't help him. No matter what you do, it'll be like a red rag to a bull. So you've got to know the dynamics. But you just have to be there like a rock for him. And then if he's got good qualities, to try and encourage his good qualities, praise him. You're a wonderful person. Say positive words. Because when you're depressed, all you can see is the bad. You can't see any good. So by you pointing out the good and you not giving him lectures and not being looking like you're worried, you know, but being strong and grounded, he's got something to rely upon. You're there for him. He will know that. It's very skillful, but you've got to be very wise with this. I hope that makes sense, Samuel.
Then also in terms of, say, with anxiety, a lot of that too is getting very obsessive about all the negative things. So in a way, it's like how can we increase our capacity for happiness?
I understand that. That's the point. So that means we have to look into the, we have got to describe the Buddhist analysis of what these states of mind are, the basic ones, and to try and understand the basic ones. You see, in the Buddhist view, they actually talk about 84,000 distinct mental problems. I mean, they're well ahead of their psychiatric volume. I wonder if there's 84,000 in the modern ones. And what's interesting, though, the Buddhist view, it's mapped out very clearly. So as young Ling Rinpoche, has he been to Australia, Ling Rinpoche?
Yep, once. Oh, a couple of times, actually, but he's been to Langri Tangpa Center once.
Oh, amazing. Okay. Often he says, and he might have said it at Langri Tangpa, and many people tell me they haven't heard this often, and I'd never heard it. He often says, okay, so now you know the Buddhist, let's just start. The Buddhist view about these unhappy states of mind, if you read Buddhist books, you're going to see this term repeatedly, the three poisons. Sounds so cute, doesn't it? And I like to call them the three toxic emotions. And what are they? One is called ignorance, which sounds pretty abstract to us, and I'll explain. One is called attachment, and one is called aversion. Sometimes you'll see it as anger. So these sound kind of cute. Anger, attachment, oh, yeah, big deal. What's my real problem? Oh, I've got ADOD, you know, whatever it is. Anger, attachment sounds silly. They just sound a bit sort of simplistic to us. But these are primordially deep in our minds. And these three are the root of the other 82,997. So as Ling Rinpoche said, 21,000 of those 84 are rooted in ignorance. 21,000 are rooted in attachment. 21,000 are rooted in anger. And the other 21,000 are rooted in all three. So what they've got, this map of the mind, and this is so unusual for us. I mean, we're talking the internal process, not the brain. This has happened 3,000 years ago. The Buddha came along and took this with him. So there's this very distinct presentation of all these different thousands upon thousands of conceptual stories deep in our minds, some so instinctive, that's why we call them feelings. They're so automatic. They're like instinctive, you know, and we are born with these instinctive things. So to unpack and unravel them is pretty sophisticated. So, okay, these three poisons, it sounds so simple, but if we really understood these three as a basis, as a map for observing our own mind, we would have a profound understanding of our own mind and therefore of somebody else's, you know. So ignorance is the two main words they use for these unhappy ones. But as Lama Yeshe, as I pointed out in Mahamudra, Lama's got about 21 different terms, many of which he's made up, just to try and convey to us the character of these unhappy states of mind, you know. But the two main ones are like disturbing emotion. Often the term used in the literature is affliction, but I never use that. I think it's a silly, boring, arcane word. Never mind. Lama doesn't use it either. But disturbing emotions, and that's pretty evident. But the other word, delusion, which sounds so peculiar to us. If somebody accused you of being delusional, you'd be really offended, you know. But this is the point where we begin to understand these different states of mind, the three poisons and all the others. When we really begin to understand them, this makes profound sense. So forget the ignorance is this deep instinct. There's a hierarchical relationship between these three. So the root one is primordially deep inside us. We don't even have a term for this in modern psychology. You know, it's a primordially deep, panic-stricken, fear-based, wrong sense of self. It's bereft, lonely, cut off, concrete, solid, and there's something so subtle we don't even see it. On the basis of that, these are the two main ones. These run the show in our daily life. And all the other dramas like jealousy and arrogance and low self-esteem and all the others all are rooted in these two. It's very fascinating. So we need to understand then what is attachment and what is the one what is the one called aversion. I mean, the rest of the three talks, we can just be just on these. Lama Yeshe said, I could tell you about attachment for a whole year. You'll never begin to understand until you start building something up inside. So, okay. Attachment, as far as the Four Noble Truths are concerned, Buddha's teaching, his first teaching, is the main cause of all suffering of all sentient beings in daily life, period. So forget the root delusion, but effectively in daily life, attachment for the animals, for humans and everything. This is a very shocking concept to have. This is not the analysis in modern science. So it's so profoundly different. So let's see what he means by this. Attachment is there as a default assumption deep in the bones of our being. It's multifaceted. Once we understand attachment, we can understand the rest. We can understand anxiety, we can understand fears, we can understand worry, we can understand panic, we can understand anger, we can understand jealousy. Once we understand attachment, this is so fascinating. And of course, it's not the modern analysis. This is very clear. So attachment is multifaceted. The deepest level of it, and Lama Sopa says this is the greatest suffering in the West. The deepest level of it, there's like this energetic level, the deepest, most primordial level of it, beyond learning, mummy didn't teach you this, is this profound feeling of dissatisfaction. I haven't got enough. I'm not thin enough. I'm not beautiful enough. I mean, forget about that. I don't have enough. First of all, out there, it's not enough cake. It's not enough food. It's not enough money. The boyfriend, he tells me he loves me. It's not enough. It's a constant unhappy dissatisfaction. And you can see some people like this all the time and they're always upset. It's never enough. But when it's really serious, it becomes, I am not enough. And this is what then becomes self-loathing. So the irony is it's the result of attachment. It's this endless, this never satisfied. And you know, we talk about a half glass full and a full glass full or a glass half empty, isn't it? It's this attitude that's so instinctive. And we mightn't think of it ourselves, but you know some people like this. No matter what they get, it's not enough. They're always miserable, always dissatisfied. Don't hear it as something cute. It's profound. And it's the result of, Buddha would say, practicing attachment in the past. But never mind all that now. The next level of it, naturally, if you're dissatisfied, and we all have ordinary levels of this. You're sitting there and you're just not satisfied and you don't know why. And so, of course, when you're not satisfied, there's something missing, isn't there? So you've got what's missing. Oh, then you think of chocolate cake. And the mind gets all excited. This is the next level of attachment. You think about what's missing. You hanker after something. So you've got to have chocolate cake. Then you get all excited. This is the next level of attachment. It now embellishes and gets all excited about it and anticipates it. And then you manipulate to get it. And all the time it's exaggerating the deliciousness of the cake until eventually you get it in the mouth. And all this buildup of a story that's so instinctive in us, this anticipating, this manipulating, this expecting, this controlling, and then the getting, and then the waiting for the satisfaction to come. The waiting for, oh, now I'm satisfied. And then what happens? You know, you eat too much and now you feel full and now you're not satisfied the other way. And it never ends. So basically that's attachment. It's dissatisfaction, hankering after something, always wanting something more, getting it, and then never being satisfied with it. Because the fact is, and this takes a really long time to actually see logically, getting what attachment wants actually doesn't bring satisfaction. It just brings more craving. This is the irony. My mother used to say, I'd think about it. She say, the more you get, the more you want. So this is the pain of attachment. We kind of know it, but we don't join the dots and we don't give it a label like that in modern psychology. We say needy. That's an example of attachment. Control freak. That's attachment. Always expecting. That's attachment. Always looking into the future. That's attachment. Always wanting something more. That's attachment. Never satisfied, that's attachment. It's multifaceted. We have a half a dozen names for it, different diseases, but it's all the same disease. This is the primordial one that runs the universe, Buddha says. Now, the millisecond, so putting it in a more primordial way, it's basically an assumption deep in our bones. And this seems a bit embarrassing and a bit depressing to hear it, but it's necessarily totally self-centered. It's rooted in this panic-stricken wrong sense of an isolated moi. It's just not happy, you know? So it's necessarily panic-stricken and for I. Now, alongside this, we do have our virtues. Thank goodness, they're our saving grace. We do have love and kindness and patience and generosity. And this is a key point. The person who's got bucket loads of attachment, but if they've got lots of love and kindness and generosity, they won't suffer so much because the love and kindness and generosity placates the attachment. But if you've got mainly attachment, but not much love and kindness and generosity, you're a mean, horrible, unhappy, suffering person. I'm not trying to be mean. So your good stuff mitigates That's the stuff that's the cause of happiness. Now, that Sunny obviously had extraordinary ability to find the way in this nightmare to become happy. I'm not joking. That's so astonishing, you know. So we've all got a bit of the good and a bit of the bad, but there's a big soup in there. And we tend, this is the biggest problem in, okay, never mind that. So, okay, we've got to become, this is a driving everything, underneath everything. So then the point is, attachment is like, one way of summarizing it, it's like this assumption that I must get what I want every millisecond. Attachment is so frantic, and we should be having compassion for ourselves. Do not hear this as criticism. Do not get guilty. This is describing our suffering. We should be weeping in compassion for ourselves, but we tend to get very, you know, moralistic. You're a bad person. No. It's this primordial assumption, this desperate, panic-stricken assumption that I've got to get what I want every second. Another way to put it is that I've got to get the nice things, because attachment can't stand problems. Now, this is the point now. What happens the millisecond attachment is thwarted? What happens when attachment doesn't get what it wants? And I'm talking the tiniest things, like getting the cup of tea when you want it, the right temperature, the right shape, the right sound, the right smell, the right touch, the husband listening to you exactly when you need it, the children doing exactly what when you want it. This is the smallest baby things. Don't wait till you put on death row to notice this. This is the tiny baby. This is the wobbles and the wheels. The millisecond attachment doesn't get what it wants or gets what it doesn't want. What is that? That's the arising of this third poison called aversion. This is so hard to see, you know. So if you'd call it, so then that too is multifaceted. This aversion is multifaceted. The volatile level of it we call anger, and that we understand. Look at the world. Shouting, killing, screaming, raping, murdering, torturing. We can see it's called anger. Don't give it fancy terms, please. It's just called anger. And what is anger? The response when attachment didn't get what it wanted. This sounds so brutal, but this is the analysis second by second by second. This process is happening. Now, you mightn't get angry, but what about on the more mild spectrum of this aversion? That's what's called anxiety. Worry, upset, frustrated, annoyed, irritated. There are variations of thwarted attachment. Now, they're the wheels wobbling, you know, but you don't notice. You just think this is normal life. You're always anxious, worried, chewing over it like a dog with a bone, never ending, never coming to a conclusion, thinking about it, anticipating what will happen. If only it'll happen, maybe it'll happen, perhaps it will happen, it didn't happen, it did happen. We just go round like maniacs, chewing it like a dog with a bone until we eventually collapse. Then the subtler, more nuanced, subtler levels of aversion, thwarted attachment, that's depression and despair. So what's happening with your son, Samuel? This is not the Western model. This is the Buddhist model. Because in his day, he's like everybody else. He wants things to go the right way, but we're never satisfied. This is the tragedy of the samsara. We're never satisfied. No matter what he gets, he's always going to be dissatisfied. All of us are like this. So if he's quiet, you know, little boy quiet because he gets depressed. Angry people don't get depressed, they just get angry. It's a volatile expression of it. But it builds up. You see, nothing ever goes astray. Nothing ever gets missing. So there he is, got this low self-esteem, which is attachment, and he's doing his homework. It's not enough. He's not good enough. He sees other kids. Oh, I'm not good enough. They're better than me. It builds up for him. Now, some kids get paranoid, get angry and volatile and beat people. No, it just all turns in and it becomes inert until he's inert and he's just profoundly like ground to a halt. So aversion has taken over. Everything looks bad. Everything looks not good enough. And now, and this stuff is so subtle. This is so subtle. It's happening for every one of us to one degree or another. And then, of course, into the mix, you're going to put your good qualities. They're our saving grace. They're our saving grace. So it's so subtle, the process of all these millions of thoughts and feelings and emotions every second. This big soup. For us, it's a big soup right now. And we can't tell one bit from another until they're shouting, you know. This is why we have to learn to pay attention. And that takes immense struggle, because the normal way we pay attention is to the outside world. From the second we wake up until the time we go to sleep, all our attention is on the outside world. And then we just assume these feelings in here are kind of these responses to the outside. Whereas we've got to reverse the process, like reversing the energy of a bomb. When things happen, instead of just looking at the external event, look at what arose in the mind. This is the job to be done. This is what we have to learn to do, you know.
Then, Venerable Ravina, what about catastrophizing, when we're constantly worrying about what if this happens or what if that happens, that really tight negative mind? Does that come from attachment or aversion?
It's both. I'd say attachment. They're so subtly mixed, you know. Attachment is the hankering, the yearning, the wanting, the expecting, the manipulating, the controlling, the dissatisfaction. So it's almost as if dissatisfaction is aversion. It's from thwarted attachment, you're never satisfied. So then you're always wanting more. And then when you don't, and then when you get more, you don't get happy. So you get annoyed. So they're so tightly linked. They're so subtly linked, you know. So the catastrophizing is exactly what all these, this is the meaning of the word delusion. So depending on your own tendency, the key function of these disturbing emotions, this is where we start to see them at a more subtle level, at the conceptual level, the stories that inform the emotions, this is beneath the physical component. We're going to see that all these attachment, anger, jealousy, pride, the stronger they are within you, the more disturbed you are, number one, but then number two, the more they exaggerate. So catastrophizing is simply exaggerating something. So when a person gets very angry very easily, the two of you could be together, and I get, you know, I'm a volatile person, so that you can be there together. We're both there and we order chocolate cake, but carrot cake comes. But we're both attached to chocolate cake, but you've got more patient attitude and you go, oh, that's okay, I can handle carrot cake. And I'll have a mental breakdown. Oh, I ordered chocolate cake. What is this? I'm never going to come to this cafe again. And you never forget as long as you live. That's catastrophizing. Delusions catastrophize. Attachment catastrophize. Anger catastrophize. Jealousy catastrophize. Absolutely low self-esteem. We make mountains out of molehills. So Sunny had this incredible emotional intelligence that she was able to not catastrophize this and actually do it, see it to her advantage. This is miraculous. But that, well, our poor fellow catastrophized, but it's normal behavior. We all catastrophize. That's exactly what delusions do. And the stronger the habit, the harder it is to see. And this is the biggest tragedy of all. I'm sitting there with the carrot cake in front of me, and so is Miffy. Same carrot cake. But Miffy is able to see it differently. She's got the ability to say, that's cool, I can handle it. And I'm just, I catastrophize, you know. That's so. And the other energy of these delusions is they're fixed and concrete and solid. There's no space to see anything differently. There's no space in them. They're neurotic and obsessive. That's why they're called so much pain.
The Venerable Ravina, like nowadays, I'd be very happy with whatever cake kind of arise. But for most of my life, I've always been so incredibly worried and anxious. And even like every time I saw Rinpoche, the first thing he'd ever say to me was, Miffy, don't worry. You know.
So why don't you describe worry? Describe it. Describe the process, the mental process.
So it's not happy, and it's a very tight anxiety about things going wrong.
Okay, this is typical. This is very normal. But everybody has that. It's normal having attachment. You see, what you're doing is you're noticing this is the thing that Buddha's saying is, this is what he means by being in samsara, quote unquote. So the very being a human, having attachment, having aversion, that is what, so in other words, you're seeing it. I don't think you saw that when you were a little girl, did you?
No, I didn't experience it as aversion, just more fear, actually.
Oh, fear, there you go. So this is what's interesting now. Okay, let's look at this one. When we've cut, if any of you Buddhists understand what I'm saying, when we've cut the root delusion, this is the subtlest one, and this is when you've got single point of concentration, you're a highly evolved yogi, and you realize emptiness. Forget that now. When you've cut the root delusion, as Lama Yeshe puts it, there's no fear. You've cut fear. Your mind is joyful and blissful. So this is something that's so fascinating for us, because fear, anxiety, worry pervade our minds. Everybody, to one degree or another, would agree that we've all got that. But the point is this, all these delusions, their main flavor is fear. I mean, we talk about, oh, look at that person over there, she's angry. Excuse me, when I had an angry fit, I'm having a complete panic attack, Miffy. It's called a panic attack. How dare you do that to me? We call it anger, but it's a panic attack. Every delusion is rooted in fear because they're vivid, they're concrete, they're solid, and we can't see. There's no space. So it's like complete panic. That exactly is having any delusions to the degree you have anxiety, jealousy, arrogance, pride, depression, you name it. You are riddled with fear. It's the nature of all the delusions. That's samsara. That's why we suffer so terribly. We're all living in panic attacks of one degree or another. That's not a joke. So that's why you can see yourself, Miffy, as you progress, lessening your neuroses, giving space between the dramas, the mind becomes more relaxed and more easygoing. You must surely see that. Fear is still there. Until you realize emptiness, there's always going to be some level of it. And we're going to see it ever more subtly.
Yeah, and panicking about the fear, like just...
And then you add panic
like
to that.
Drowning instead of
that's right. So this is also what happens. I like to call my roommates. We've got these thousands of thoughts in our head, haven't we? But I call them my roommates. And you've got the crazy roommates, the jealous ones, the worried ones, the fear. And they're all like, I mean, even in the West, we say we've got 1,000 thoughts a second. Well, Buddha would totally agree. It's just this constant mass of thought after thought after thought. We can't keep up with them. We can't look at them. We can't see them. We just feel the consequences of them, you know, when it's too late and the wheels fall off. So that's why the mind is so amazing, so vast, so extraordinary, and how we have the techniques are there to help us learn to navigate them. So all the time, these unhappy thoughts, they're in the mind. They're thought. You've got to identify each one. You know, there's that thought. There's this thought. There's that one. As much as we can. And you begin to identify these roommates. Now, the tragedy is because they're so habitual, these roommates, the negative roommates, the unhappy roommates, the dissatisfied roommates, the anxious roommates, the jealous ones, the angry ones. I mean, all depending on the person you are. We also know there's love and kindness and compassion, but those roommates, I think of them, they're hiding under the wardrobe, they're hiding under the bed. They don't have a chance. They don't get a voice. I've never yet in my whole life ever heard a person say, "Rabina, I can't stop thinking good thoughts." Nobody says that. This is the irony of samsara. We all, even though you're a kind person, you take care of everybody. You're loving, you're kind, you've got beautiful behavior. You're generous, you put your life together, you're disciplined. You know behind these little chatting thoughts, never ending. This is samsara, Buddha says. And honey, but this is the amazing point. The Buddha's point, the Buddha has found from his own direct experience that these neurotic little roommates, these exaggerators, these embellishers, these unhappy ones, they are not at the core of our being. They're just a bunch of bloody habits, you know. They're a bunch of habits. But the tragedy is, because they're so habitual, this is the part that's so shocking. We believe that they are true. So you look in the mirror, a simple one. You look in the mirror, oh, God, look at the double chins. Oh, I'm so ugly, look at this. You know, you never for one second would say to yourself, "Well, I wonder if I'm not seeing myself properly. Maybe I'm quite nice looking." No, we don't say that. 27 people can say, "No, Rabina, you're not as ugly as you think." We do not believe it. This is the bizarre tragedy of these habits. Because the thought arises, we assume it's true. One person, though, can say, "Rabina, I agree with you, you're fat and ugly." And who do you believe? The 27 people or the one? You'll believe the one. Why? Because you believe it yourself. So this is the suffering. So part of the job is to start to listen to all these crazy thoughts and to have this miracle of attention and actually listen to what it's saying. And then you're going to say, "Well, maybe it's not true. Maybe I'm not as bad as I think. Maybe things aren't as bad as I think." But we don't do that. We just believe it's true. And this is a tragedy about depression. You tell a person who's depressed the things that you know you're actually a really marvelous person. I'm not trying to say you necessarily will do that because it doesn't work because they do not believe you. And a person who's enraged, angry, think of the poor guy, the extreme example of the poor guy on death row, when his dramas are so extreme, so complete, so utterly concrete, to say to him, "Well, you know, it's not as bad as you think. We can try and do something to change." He absolutely would laugh at you. So the tragedy of the unhappy states of mind that are rooted in fear is they're concrete, set in stone, and there's not a millimeter of space around them. So putting it in Buddhist terms, there's no sense of dependent arising. There's no sense of space. The virtues, however, the positive qualities are spacious. They're not demented. They're not distressed. They're not anxious. They're not worried. And that's there our saving grace. So why Miffy is not completely in a straitjacket, completely insane from her anxiety, is because she's got some access to some of her virtues. Thank goodness, Miffy. And that's the same for all of us. So part of our problem is too, then we hear the angry thoughts and then we get angry about the angry thoughts. So we add another angry roommate to the house until you're so crowded with, you get anxious, then you're anxious about the anxiety. Then you get guilty and then you get guilty about the guilt. So we've got there's this never-ending stream of more roommates crowding in until you collapse. So we've got to start to have control over these thoughts, start giving them space. This is so hard, but this is the job, because they are all merely thoughts. This is the miracle. But they're habitual, and to the point that in other words, you believe for so long that you're no good, that you even appear. This is exactly how they talk about anorexics and bulimics, isn't it? I forgot the word they used, but you so believe you are fat and ugly, so believe you're fat and ugly, you look at your 40 kilo body in the mirror and you see fat and ugly. This is the tragedy of the delusions, you know. When you hate your husband, you so hate him, you can't see anything there, and he actually appears ugly to you. So our delusions make up, not they didn't make up the fact that your husband beat you. He did beat you, but we make up the picture of ugly husband. We make up the, if you're attached to your hubby, you're in love with your hubby, you'll see an angel. So these delusions lie to us, and then we believe the lies. Bad enough, Lama Zopa says, that things appear in a way they're not true. The tragedy is we believe them. So we can, at least even when you see the chocolate cake and you feel all the excitement and all the anticipation, all the emotional hunger, can't wait to get it in the hole here, not this hole, this one. You stop and you think, Rabina, the cake does not exist the way it appears to you through the lenses of your attachment. It's like an atomic bomb on the delusion. When you're despairing, things aren't, it doesn't happen overnight, but this is how you chip away at the misconceptions, you know. It takes great courage to do this, to be our own therapists, as Lamia, she says, you know. But the thing is, Miffy, until we've realized emptiness, we're going to have it's natural to have the dramas. It's just natural to be there. So part of the thing is we have to learn to live with it. It's like a pain in the knee. You just got to accept to learn to live with the pain instead of always thinking it shouldn't be there. The thing is, it's not the anxiety that's actually the cause of your problem. It's that you think it shouldn't be there is the cause of the problem.
Right.
But when you welcome the anxiety and bring it on and enjoy this roommate and listen to what it says and then laugh at it, that's when you dissipate the anxiety. That's when you dissipate the anger. When we accept it instead of wishing it wasn't there, that's the deepest one. We wish it wasn't there. That's the pain. That's the cause of the pain. Mm-hmm. People have been meditating. I remember one man meditating for like 30 years, never satisfied, waiting for some blissful experience. He was in tears of misery because he's always expecting something else to come, never satisfied with what he got. Got to learn to live with these roommates. This is quite profound. Live with them. Hear the anxiety, the silly little anxious Miffy in there, but then bring the kind Miffy and intelligent Miffy and strong Miffy out, all the different, don't say that. No, it's not Miffy's. It's the different thoughts. Label them accurately and bring out the virtuous ones and argue a little bit with the other ones or just tell them to shut up and pat them on the head.
So when they're happening though, Venerable Rabina, like how do we experientially, how do we know what's what? Because a lot of the emotions that come up, in my experience, are just like emotional sensations. They're just like physical sensations.
I know, but that's our problem. That's the problem. But that's too late. You can't do much with the physical sensation. You've got to go back to basics and start getting some concentration and start watching your thoughts before the dramas come. Watch your thoughts while you're doing the dishes. Watch your thoughts while things are going nicely. But that's our problem. We only think we have to look at the wheels when they're wobbling, but you've got to be checking them all the time before they start having a mental breakdown. Then you can start to hear the different thoughts quietly and handle the baby events. So, you know, in other words, I always use the dumbest example, but this attachment is always wanting everything to be perfect, right? That's the deep behind it. So then you're doing the dishes. I use the stupidest example and you drop a cup. You have a mental breakdown. I shouldn't have dropped a cup. Oh my God, I broke a cup. You're checking out to see who's watching you break a cup. Mummy told you shouldn't break a cup. You've programmed yourself with I shouldn't break a cup. So anger comes, guilt comes, just breaking a bloody cup. Well, how about saying, that's okay, break another cup. It's all right. So just argue with it, relax. But those events build up. because we're all trying to be, always trying to be good girls. And we've got God in, we've internalized God, mummy, daddy, the police, grandma, grandpa. And this is the deepest attachment, always trying to live up to some fantasy of what we think we're supposed to be. So we go mad. So accept, just accept that you broke a cup. It's okay to break a cup. Don't worry. Instead of making it one more painful thought in the mind. It's a simple baby example. And there's 1,000 events a day when attachment won't get what it wants. And even when it does get what it wants, it doesn't last anyway. So we're still going to end up with dissatisfaction. It's so subtle, this attachment.
And so then, Venerable Rabina, on the other side of the coin, then what about people like sociopaths, or, you know, sometimes people talk about, say, Asperger's, or people that have, that aren't very moved by anything at all, don't have, you know, are profoundly unmoved by samsara. Is there any hope for them?
I think this is a terrible, terrible, terrible set of misconceptions in many of those people. I think it's quite shocking, actually. You know, that, what's that Swedish girl or the Danish girl who went out, sat outside Parliament? What was she? Who went around
Greta
the world?
Greta Thunberg.
That one. She's classically called that. And so many people who get called that, and or that lesbian comedian who became famous, the Tasmanian lesbian who became famous in America.
Yes, Hannah right. Gatsby.
So I think we say, oh, I've been called bipolar or Asperger's or something, and we almost then wear it like a badge. But I think there's a series of assumptions, in my opinion, using the Buddhist analysis and then looking at the Western analysis. The Western analysis is based upon the assumption that a healthy person has bucket loads of attachment and neediness and emotional hunger and anger and jealousy. I think that's the view in our culture. We give equal status to the neuroses and the virtues. So if you can have a person, let's say from a yogi from a past life, who doesn't have many delusions, so they don't have much emotional hunger. They've got a brilliant a brilliant intelligent mind, but they don't have much neuroses. They don't have much emotional hunger for having 47 friends. They don't get jealous. They don't get anxious. Then we consider them mentally ill. This is the worst mistake you could imagine. They're not mentally ill. They're healthy. Okay, I'm not saying some people don't have a serious problem who really are disconnected from the world. That's a different problem. But ordinary, I mean, you know, there's a friend of ours, you don't know her, I don't think, Miffy, but her daughter, one of Lama Zopa's students, her son, since he was tiny, okay, he was like two, showing all the symptoms of what we call, it's bipolar, isn't it? The serious one is bipolar, isn't it?
No, autism, you're thinking.
Autism, wrong one. But they're all variations of attachment and aversion, don't worry about it. I'm not being sarcastic. So autism, that's right. He was considered like that because he's this maniac, up at 5 in the morning, bed at night, never stopping, super intelligent, very obsessive to get what he wants and everything, but a brilliant mind. And she was really worried. I said, for God's sake, go and ask Lama Zopa. So he could see immediately who he was, and he gave him all these practices, recite the Heart Sutra, memorize mantras and heart, super genius little mind. So I said, why not send his picture and a few symptoms to the Tibetan doctor? They're yogis. And he wrote back and said, yes, this is how yogis behave. So a person, you see, the Buddha's view is so radically different. The Buddha's view is that we can get rid of completely all neuroses, all fear, all anger. This is mental illness in the West. So the assumptions in the West are very, very different. So that little Thornburg girl, whatever she is, she wears that badge proudly and makes a fuss about it because the world does. But we consider her abnormal. So in other words, a little girl, you can think of two little girls playing in their room and they both got typical attachment and neediness, and we're born with this, Miffy, and especially the attachment. This is the deepest one, and we can spend the next 2 days talking just this one, and I will. The deepest attachment we have, more than for sex, drugs, and rock and roll, is the craving to be seen and approved of by other people. This is born in us. So there's two little girls playing in their dolls, or two little boys playing, and they're typical. They've got lots of attachment to get what they want, lots of attachment for the other little girl to like her. So they're all over each other like a rash, all needy and playing, burst into tears and hug each other. Well, a little girl who didn't have attachment, she'd be able to walk away, but she would be called autistic. But no, she just doesn't have attachment. She hasn't had all this emotional neediness. And we think that's weird, but she'd have love, she'd have kindness, she'd have patience, she'd have forgiveness. So it's a very different series of assumptions in the Western model, I'd say. And I really question those analyses for certain kinds of people. Seriously, disconnected children, yes, you can see they've got a real problem.
Yeah, so one of our students, her child was diagnosed as being a sociopath because they didn't have much
feeling for anything. They were completely unmoved. But I really questioned that because they wanted to be a vet. So they clearly had feeling, you know, for the welfare of animals.
That's exactly right. They shouldn't have attachment. They didn't have much attachment. And because attachment is so enormous for all of us, this emotional hunger in us, we consider you'd be mentally ill if you don't have it. This is why Buddha's view is so radical and why we need to look at it so carefully. It's a really profound point, you know.
And then what about with what we'd call actual psychopaths, like people unable to feel empathy and a great desire to control others?
That's overwhelming attachment and overworld. And this is where you can't, you see, the bigger picture in Buddhism, you've got to factor in karma. You've got to factor it in. Like I've got a friend on death row, Mitchell, who's a Buddhist, and his friend, I know him. When I give talks, he comes to the talks. And I see him, he sits there very relaxed. He's a very low-key guy. And so Mitchell told me that Rabina, he thinks of torture all the time. Now, think of what a pedophile is. They think of sexual contact with a child all the time. What is a thief? A person who thinks of taking things all the time. What about a person who's a fisherman? Please don't misunderstand me here. They think of killing fish all the time. So due to past habits plus attachment equals this. This is exactly what it is. This man on death row, he can't tell you why he thinks of torture all the time, but that's he's born with that tendency from the past life. That's why the materialist, you know, analysis falls apart. You know, these wackos who get, you know, these kids get, you know, multi-murderous kids go around killing, and then they look into, even look into their brains trying to find out what happened. Or you look into the parents trying to find what the parents did, and you can't find any evidence because you're looking into the wrong place. This is why karma in the big picture to the Buddhist view, you've got to factor in the things you come into this life programmed with. So if you're this guy on death row, he's got many good qualities, a nice guy, but he can't stop thinking about torture. That's exactly the symptom of attachment. Now look at most of us. Look at our attachment. We think of food all the time, for God Almighty's sake. The pedophile can't stop thinking about little children all the time. Of course, we hate them and we love to hate them and we call them a monster and we should, and wish they burn in hell. I mean, what about people who, you know, cut humans and eat them for breakfast? Because they've been animals recently, but they've done that. We come programmed with our tendencies. Then you have to factor that in to explain. So a psychopath has got a person who's totally addicted to killing, torturing, stealing, has therefore the delusions dominate their mind and their poor little virtues are completely hidden down in their feet somewhere. They can't access them because their delusions are so pervasive. That's exactly the point. We've all got different balance of the delusions and the virtues. That's the explanation. It's so clear. Do you understand? And of course, when we understand our own mind, then we can begin to have compassion. So sure, I'm glad this friend's on death. I'm not glad he's on death row, but I'm glad he's not out there torturing people. I know the guy, you know, he's got other good qualities. He doesn't only have the wish to torture. He's a kind guy. And interesting, he doesn't try to torture his friends. They like him. They get along with each other. But his poor mind is demented. What do you think a pedophile is? What do you think anybody is? But look at apathetic attachment. It's food, for God's sake. We can't stop thinking about it all day. We get it. You know, I go to bed at night thinking about my morning cup of tea. I'm doing my practice in the morning, anticipating breakfast. What will I have this morning? I've got it all organized. I'm going to have eggs today. Now I'll have toast today. I mean, this is pathetic. Thank God it's not to wish to torture. Aren't we lucky?
Or I just think about when I'm going to sleep.
There you go. Sleep's the main one. At night, yeah. During my practice at night, all I can do is see my bed. During morning breakfast, all I can think of is in my morning practice, all I see is my breakfast. No, I know. So we are pathetic attachments. And one of the functions of attachment is you think of the object all the time. So can you imagine if you're born with a tendency to torture? You don't know why. You don't know why. I mean, this is what's so tragic when you understand the view of karma, at least that informs who we are. Yeah, but we just freak out and think they're monsters and they should burn in hell, you know?
So then, Venerable, how do we support, like, you know, there's one in 100 people apparently are Asperger's or autistic. So how do we actually support someone like that who isn't driven by attachment but is looked at as being somehow broken, you know?
My feeling is those labels, they're such a spectrum, it's demented. You've got to be far more intricate in observing. So we don't see it in terms of ethics. Say maybe a person doesn't have much attachment to food, but they mightn't have much other virtue, so they mightn't be necessarily such a nice person. So I think it's really so gross the way they label all those people. Mm-hmm. Now, this little boy, the one who the doctor said that's how yogis behave, you look at his virtues and they're his saving grace. But another kid mightn't have many virtues, which doesn't mean he's healthy. It doesn't mean he's healthy. So it's far more nuanced than the materialist model would say, I would suggest. Do you understand?
Yeah,
we need an intricate view of the mind, you know, to see, and that's why we've got to see their good qualities. What are his ethics? What are his good qualities? I mean, some kids get raging, totally silent, locked in themselves, but get lots of anger when they don't get what they want. That's because they've got masses of anger. But I mean, I think if you look at the Buddhist model, if you really understand all the different delusions and all the different virtues, that's the map you would use first to know your own mind, Miffy, and then you can see the minds of others. That's why the lamas are clairvoyant. They're not mystical. They just can see the mind vividly and nakedly. They know each delusion, each virtue, each karma. They've got wisdom. They see it. It's not mystical. We have to learn that wisdom.
So there's a couple more questions. One is, say, for something physical like epilepsy, is that also attachment where you just can't stand it?
You mean if you have epilepsy and you get angry, you get upset? Yeah, of course, everything. This sounds too extreme. So please try and hear me properly. Put it this way. Lama Zopa Rinpoche, for example, our Lama, you might know him, but back in 2011 at a Tisha Center near Bendigo in Victoria, he had a stroke. Okay, now he's said to be, by all the other Lamas, I don't know, I'm not clairvoyant, he's said to be a holy being. In other words, he's reached a level where he's gone beyond ego, beyond attachment, beyond anger, jealousy. I mean, this is the point you've got to understand. In Buddhism, we can get rid of those neuroses. So what's left in his mind is only wisdom, joy, compassion, kindness, to levels that we can't even imagine, honestly. So you've got to posit this possibility. So there he is, he had a stroke and he's in the hospital. The next morning, I mean, because they took him to this local Catholic hospital near Bendigo. And I remember Roger, his attendant, went in, and a couple of Tibetan monks went there with him. And these Catholic nuns, over the period that the Lama Zopa was there, could not get over these amazing monks. They were laughing all the time. They were hysterical. He was laughing. Lama Zopa was joyful all the time. He had a stroke. The next morning, Roger sent a little video message from Rinpoche after he had this the first night. He was like, he looked like a senile drunk. He couldn't speak any words. He was on these drugs, but he was laughing. He was joyful. This is demented. Who's joyful when they have a stroke? But so if you have no attachment, no ego, no jealousy, no resentment, no neurosis, you have no fear, your mind is only joyful and full of compassion. So that became an experience for Rinpoche to have to triple his compassion for others. He was able to completely experience his suffering for the sake of others. I mean, this sounds like science fiction to us. But this is the way the Buddhism describes. So whatever the suffering is we have, this is not trying to be mean to us. Of course, it's natural we get angry, we get a knee ache. It's natural you have a panic attack, and it's terrible when you have an epileptic fit. You know, it's terrible suffering. Our mind completely goes berserk, you know. It's impossible unless we're highly realized beings. We will just be, we'll be absorbed in the headache, absorbed in the knee ache, absorbed in the epileptic fit. We'll have a panic attack about it. We'll worry about it. We'll get upset about it. Whatever it is, this is normal behavior. But all the Buddha's saying is we can learn to work with these work like the woman on death row. You can learn to change the mind step by baby step to learn to recognize one thing is the body and two is the mind, and we can change the mind, but one step at a time. You know, don't hear it as punitive and bad and guilty, and it's not meant to be like that. It's just sort of showing we've got the ability to reinterpret things, to see things differently. That's the answer to that.
And so then just to kind of cap it off, Daria's asking about, you know, in the West we talk about people when they have emotional dysregulation.
What's that?
Is that all an expression of extreme attachment?
I don't know what that is. What's the definition of that?
I'm not sure myself.
Daria, tell us. What is it, Daria?
Where are you, Daria? Can you type into the chat or let me know?
Where's Daria? I can't see Daria.
Daria, what do you mean?
Daria, talk to me. Sweetheart, what do you mean by that, darling?
Hello, can you hear me?
I can hear you, sweetheart.
Hi. Hello. Thank you. Firstly, thank you very much for this talk. It's fascinating and very interesting. Good. So by emotional dysregulation in Western psychology, it's when a person is very emotional and perhaps unable to control their extreme emotions. So when they're angry, they're very angry. When it's a person without emotional breaks.
Okay.
Perhaps due to trauma or just something has happened in our lives or genetics or whatever.
No, I understand. I really hear it. And I suppose, Dari, if we look at it on a spectrum, I mean, in the most simple sense, we're all variations of that. Some people have good discipline. Some people have some kind of strong ethics or whatever the reason is due to their personality, due to their education. They're able to manage or handle their emotions. But maybe I doubt even that. My sense is we either vomit everything out, which is perhaps you're suggesting that's that one. Whatever you feel, it comes pouring out, or you suppress. And we don't tend to have either another option. Whereas this approach in Buddhism is this third option of developing this incredible skill to be aware, to be conscious at an ever deeper level, conscious of what's going on, so that you can learn to navigate it and be in control of it and work with it and change it. And I'm suggesting Sunny was a good example of that. So we're all variations of this, I would say. Would you see what I'm saying, Daria? Do you agree with my point?
Oops. Yes, thank you. Thank you for that. So again,
vomit it all out, no control at all, vomit everything out, or completely live in denial and suppressed. And we often can see that people like that, they're the good girls who want to be mummy's helper, and you'd never say the wrong thing, never do the wrong thing. You'd hide it. But of course, you can't see it either. And then it's got to come out one day, and no wonder you get called PTSD or whatever it is. So this third option is having this awareness, this incredible skill to be conscious eventually, moment by moment, so we can learn to have control, to live in good ethics, to be navigating it, not suppressing, not denying, and not vomiting. That's the real skill we're all trying to learn, Daria.
So
thank you, Dana.
Hang on a second. Do you understand, Daria? Hang on. Do you understand, Daria? Am I clear? Makes sense. Unmute yourself. I just want to hear you answer, Daria. Unmute yourself, darling.
Yes, that makes sense. Thank you very much.
Good.
Thank you.
Good. Thanks, darling. Thanks. Yes, Miffy, go on.
Oh, just thinking. So, you know, in the extreme of the moment, how do we begin to create that space? And like you mentioned just before, of dependent arising creates the space. So I'm really intrigued. How do we do that?
You mean at the time of the drama?
Yes.
You mean at the time that you're going 120 k's an hour and your wheel's falling off?
Yes. What do we
do? I'm sorry. No, Miffy, there's very little you can do then, because the best you can do is damage control.
Right.
And get any wits that you've got. But mostly that's when and that's why we all have mental breakdowns. You can't do much, but the learning from it is I better go back to basics and learn bloody mechanics and learn to be aware of my mind and be conscious before the wheels fall off. That's the only thing is learning. The best you can do is damage control, darling, and hope you don't kill your husband.
Yeah. Yeah, so often we just do damage control. We stop the car. The wheels may or may not have fallen off, but we're not going anymore, and we think, great, it's fixed.
or you die. You're sitting there with a knife in your hand and wondering what the hell bloody hell happened. You know, that's the tragedy. Let's be more dramatic. That's why there's so much suffering. That's why we have, I mean, why do you think so many people kill themselves in our culture? It is beyond unbearable pain, because that's the wheels falling off. We do not see any option. Or you kill your husband or you kill yourself. Or like, you know, even the one of, they say it's like a number in the, you know, the UN something or other, that the 40% of all women on the planet who get killed are killed by the bloke in the same bed. That's the bloody wheels falling off, Miffy. Because there's no awareness, there's no conscious, nobody knows their mind. These two people, first living in a fantasy of thinking they're gorgeous, then attachment doesn't get what it wants, then they get angry, then they get jealous, and they build it up, and they build it up, and one day she's dead. 40% on this planet, or look at the people who kill themselves, because this is the damage control. This is the wheels falling off, because we never pay attention to the mind. Not to mention all the milder versions, people who live in torture all their lives on 47 drugs, because we don't pay attention to our mind. This is the unbearable tragedy of our society. Are we communicating, Pim?
Yep, we are. It's very loud and clear.
Good. So we have confidence, okay? Have confidence and delight in your good roommates. Bring them out. Don't just keep listening to the stupid rubbish ones. They're there. Give them a kiss and then bring out kindness and bring out self-confidence and bring out love and forgiveness and generosity to yourself first. Bring them out loud and clear. Say the words. And then they all start to, then we start to identify with those instead of the other nonsense. And then the more you identify with your good thoughts, the ones will eventually disappear. They'll be gone like a puff of smoke. Anger will be gone. Bye-bye. Anger out the door, gone, left, never can come back. because they're all thoughts. Okay. Goodbye and good luck.
Oh, that's great. So, Venerable, I'm offering you a carta and thank you over across space.
There you are. Thank you so much in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Thank you, darlings.
And and on behalf of everybody, we're offering you a carta and I'd like to add some vitamin C into it for your health. And hoping that you'll you recover completely and that you're full of beans and energy for the coming.
I'm recovering pretty much. I had this awful mask of a rash. So I did all these different things. I got a good acupuncturist and my sister Polly in Melbourne, she knows an Italian herbalist. And he's famous for making all these herbs. So she sent me a whole bunch of things. So I think I'm getting better.
Thank you, darling. Thank you so much for your words of wisdom and your inspiration. Thank you,
darling. And everybody, please be optimistic. Don't be scared of your crazy roommates. Welcome them, pat them on the head. But no, they don't define you. The virtuous ones define you. They are who you are. So bring them out from under the mattress. Bring them out from the cupboard and the wardrobe and say them, I am okay. I have got potential. My mind is pure in its nature. I can do it. It's okay. I can learn to check the wheels before they fall off. Then we will never have a mental breakdown. It's possible. It's definitely possible. Okay, darlings. Much love.
Thank you.
Give up. See you next week.
See you next week.
Bye, darlings. Thank you so much.